We're going to think on this passage that Rachel read to us, picking up on this these amazing words that Jesus spoke as he encourages his disciples how to live. But before we get into what he said, I just want us to reflect on what we get in the first verse, where we see Jesus sitting down. I just want to reflect on that for a moment. Most places that you go to today to hear somebody speaking, if you go to a lecture, if you go to a school classroom, you will normally find the person who is speaking standing up. And that's what we've come to expect. And that's the norm here. There are exceptions. There's a friend of mine who is a minister in the Meese Valley who has gone down with motor neurone disease, and it's obviously really impacting him, and it's got to the point when the times he is able to preach, he preaches sitting down, because physically he can't stand up for very long. And it's different enough that people notice. It's not what they expect. Incidentally, assuming he's well enough, he's coming to speak at our men's breakfast in November. So if you're a man, and if you're free, that Saturday morning, the third Saturday in November, do come along. He's a great guy. He's got a great story to tell about his life. He's had a very varied life. And his story of faith and the way in which his faith is helping him through his illness is really encouraging. So there's a trailer for you. But in the time of Jesus, when somebody sat down, it said something significant. He was adopting the posture of a teacher. He was going to pass on something that was important, something that was authoritative, some insight, some direction to his students, to his listeners. And so as Jesus sits down, people see this and they come. They want to hear what this teacher has to say. They want to listen to him. They want to get an insight into the way in which he thinks and the way in which they are encouraging them to live. I wonder this morning, do we have that same desire from Jesus to hear from him, to learn from him, to be transformed by what we hear? As we look at these amazing words that he spoke. And Jesus starts off by talking about being blessed. Some translations talk about being happy. And it's one of those words that we find difficult to properly express the meaning, the original intention of the word in our English language. And blessed comes close, but the way we've started to use that word in our language today, it doesn't really communicate what Jesus was trying to say. But what I do know is that this idea of being blessed, being happy, is something that's important to people. People have a major focus on seeking happiness in life. It seems to be a major driver for people. The American Declaration of Independence from 1776 states that happiness is a right for everyone. We hold these truths to be self-evident. That certain unalienable rights, among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We note that these were written by men, but hey, what can you do? Happiness is something that was recognised as something that people want. Some of you will have seen Wilbur Smith's film in 2006 called The Pursuit of Happiness, where he picks up that theme and works to provide a life of happiness and comfort for him and for his son. A work colleague once told me that he was leaving his wife because she was no longer able to make him happy, as though that was her role in their relationship. On our first Alpha evening, we're running an Alpha course on Monday evenings, on our first Alpha evening, Nicky Gumbel, the person behind the whole Alpha project, was talking about his drive as a student to find happiness in life. It's something that seems to be vitally important to us and something we feel we deserve, and that when we don't have it, something is seriously wrong. And so we invest time and effort and money into achieving it. But in the Bible, we only find the word happy 29 times, maybe slightly different in different translations, with only 6 of those in the New Testament. It is a word Jesus has only recorded as using twice, in a parable in Matthew 25, where he's speaking about somebody else being happy. But Jesus uses this word blessed 30 times, 9 of them in this passage. And it's as though this is what he's more focused on, that this idea of being blessed is important, and something he assumes his followers want to experience as well. So it's worth asking the question, what does it mean? And we get into that, or we get an example of that when I'd lost the plot with technology. I do that from time to time. We get a hint of that when Mary, the mother of Jesus, reflects on the news that she's going to have a baby, the Son of God, where she speaks about all generations calling her blessed because of what God has done for her. And what Mary is saying, and what is behind what Jesus is saying, is that this idea of being blessed, it's about being in a good place. It's being in a secure place. It's being in a contented place because of what God has done in someone's life. It's not a guarantee of escaping all life's pressures and challenges, but it is about recognizing the wonderful things that God has done for his people and will do for them. It's not about how we feel on any particular day. Rachel, at the beginning of our service, talked about the weeks we've had and the weeks that we have ahead of us. Some of those are difficult and challenging. But this state is not about any particular day or what's going on, whether we're up or down, but it's about, in all situations, realizing and remembering the position we occupy in God's presence. And it's this knowledge of being in a good and right relationship with God, of experiencing his goodness to us, that seems to be, to Jesus, of much more interest and importance than whether we are just happy. How does that align with our thinking, with our objectives, with how we seek to organise and plan our lives? What is our focus? What is important to us? And what Jesus is saying at the beginning of this passage that we now call the Sermon on the Mount is that this state of being blessed is part of what being a disciple, of what being a follower of him is all about. And he goes on to say, blessed are. Blessed are these, blessed are those, and so on. He speaks about 9 different contexts in which people are blessed. 9 ways of being or acting that flow from being in this type of relationship with God. We don't do these things to gain or to earn God's blessing. We can never do that. We only come into that relationship with God through receiving Jesus and believing in what he has done for us. But these things that Jesus is talking about are character traits that flow from having come to that point, from committing to live as a follower of Jesus. And in each of these statements, Jesus follows a particular formula, a statement about the sort of person and the reason why they should be recognized as blessed. So you have in verse 3, blessed are the poor in spirit. That's the statement as to the people who are blessed. And then he goes on to give the reason why, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. A few details. In most cases, the consequences are spoken of as being in the future. Blessed are because they will. But in 2 cases, verse 3 and 10, they're spoken of as taking place in the present. All 9 of them are thinking about what it means to live as a citizen of God's kingdom, as a disciple of Jesus. Some of the blessings are to be received fully in the future, but the amazing thing is we can start to experience them even now. And I don't know if you noticed, as Rachel was reading, that there's a shift in verse 11. where Jesus moves from speaking about people in general to specifically refer to his disciples. Blessed are the meek or the merciful, those who are persecuted. Then blessed are you when people insult you, and so on. It's much more direct. It's as though those who choose to follow him should expect insults, persecution, evil actions against them. When you think about it, that's quite a challenge. It may require us to change the way we think about things, because I would suggest that this is not the expectation that most of us have in life, that we set ourselves up to be insulted and persecuted and be slandered. But Jesus seems to be saying that we should expect it. Have things changed? Or are we not living the way Jesus meant us to? Are we not having the impact in the world that caused people to not like us? We'll think about that a little later. So very briefly, as we look at these nine things, what sort of character and behaviour is Jesus speaking about? And what are the consequences of living in this way, both in terms of how we relate to God and how we relate to other people? I'm going to suggest the first four are about our relationship with God. And there are many different ways of looking at these, but I'm going to suggest that this poor in spirit is about those who recognise their dependence on God. Recognise that they can do nothing in their own strength to become right with God, but they need him for that change of state in their lives. He is the only one who can deal with their sin. They can't do anything about it for themselves. But it is for those people who recognise their need of God, they are the people who can enter into, become part of God's kingdom. Those who mourn, we mourn for many reasons, but I think what Jesus is trying to point out here is those who recognise that they are by nature sinners, they have failed, they have messed up, and they can do nothing about it to put it right. And they grieve over that reality. Those of us who believe in Jesus have received forgiveness for our sin, and that's a wonderful state to be in. But are we truly sorry for it? Do we confess it to God? Do we repent over it? Do we choose to turn away from it? Or do we treat God's forgiveness cheaply and lightly? And what Jesus is saying is, as we do that, we will be comforted in a way that only God can comfort. As we recognise the forgiveness that only God can provide and no one can take from us. Meekness. I think here there's an idea of understanding really and truly who we are and being amazed that God can think of us in the positive way that he does. Joe and I were at a memorial service yesterday afternoon of an aunt of mine. And one of the things that was said about her, as people were reflecting on the Christian life that she lived over many, many years, was her continual question as to why me? Why would Jesus love me? She recognised her failings. She recognised her flaws. And she was continually amazed at the love that Jesus had for her. Jesus, God, looks on us in an amazingly positive way. And those of this idea of meekness is understanding who we are and being amazed at the love God pours into our lives. And such people, Jesus says, will inherit the earth. Why? Because the earth belongs to Jesus, and we will inherit everything that he has. Seeking righteousness. Many people are ambitious. The question raised here is what we should be ambitious for. And we're told that we are blessed if we hunger and thirst after righteousness. Wanting to see society working well, with the oppressed being helped and justice being available to all. It's really encouraging to hear about that programme that's airing on Friday evening. And as we seek justice and help, there's this deep sense of satisfaction as we see God's kingdom taking a step further forward. So what do these first four tell us? I think it says that we've got to recognise our own inability to please God in our own strength. We can't do that. We've messed up, we've failed. We can find forgiveness in Jesus. But we do continue to grieve and to mourn over the cause of our sin, the thing that got in the way that caused Jesus to die. And we allow this understanding of ourselves to affect how we behave. It motivates us in the way in which we live. And it gives us a deep sense of longing for what is right and what is good. So, the first four. The next four I'm going to suggest are to do with our relationship with others. There's this idea of being merciful, feeling compassion for, acting out of that sense of compassion to those who are in need, those who are experiencing pain or sadness or grief. And as we act mercifully towards others, we will ourselves receive mercy from God. It's not that we deserve mercy because we show mercy, or that we deserve forgiveness because we forgive. But it's that we cannot really receive and enter into the mercy and forgiveness of God unless we are prepared to extend that and offer that to others. Mercy. Pure in heart. It's about inward purity. It's about living a moral life because of what God has done for us. It is that, but it's also about being sincere in our relationships with others and not being deceitful in any way. If our hearts are pure, then our relationship with others can withstand deep scrutiny. And nothing wrong will be found in our thoughts or motives or how we engage with other people. When we see God, all that is wrong and deceitful will be burned away, and as pure people, we will be welcomed into his presence. And Jesus is calling us to live lives that demonstrate that type of purity today. Are there things in our hearts, in our minds, in our thoughts, which are impure, that are getting in the way of our relationship with other people? If so, that is not what Jesus is expecting in those who have committed themselves to follow him. God is in the business of making peace, of bringing reconciliation, of drawing people back into relationship with himself and with other people, of restoring creation. The supreme demonstration of that is when he made peace with us by the blood that Jesus shed on the cross. Paul speaks about that in Colossians. And we, in turn, as we join in God's work, are called to be peacemakers in the situations we are in. And it could take many forms. It is hard work. But as we engage in it, we live as children of our Heavenly Father. Persecution. I mentioned this earlier. There's this recognition that those who live in this way will often find themselves being persecuted. Some people won't accept peace. Some people will refuse to be reconciled. Some people will object to how we live and what we do. And sometimes they will respond by persecuting us as we seek to live for the Jesus that they have ignored or rejected. Jesus tells his followers they should expect it. And he encourages them to rejoice when that happens, which might not be our first response. But he gives two reasons for why we should. Nothing that is done to us can interfere with the reward that God has for us in heaven. That is safe. That is secure. Whatever people say about us, whatever people say to us, whatever people do to us. And it's a demonstration that we are being obedient to God. A badge that Jesus says we share with many who have gone before, and a badge that we share with Jesus himself. This is association with Jesus in a deep and powerful way. So it's not something that should surprise us when it happens, but something we should expect as we seek to live as fully committed followers of Jesus. There's a cost. It's a cost that Jesus encourages us to bear. It's a cost that Jesus was willing to carry himself. So in this second group of four, we're called to live in a particular way, a way that's driven by that relationship with God that the first four speaks about, and a way that is totally at odds with the society in which we live. John Stott referred to this whole thing as counter-cultural living. This is not how our culture encourages us to be, but it's how Jesus calls us to be. A way that encourages us to be compassionate to those in need, not to step on them or over them. A way that encourages us to be open and honest with each other, not to hide behind masks or to rejoice in secrets. A way that calls us to seek peace, to make peace and not conflict. A way that we accept and recognise will result in people not liking what we stand for or what we do, and sometimes reacting against us. This is some of what Jesus was talking about as he speaks about how it is that those who are blessed, those who are in that relationship with God, live and behave and work. As we thought about those, it's good to take a moment to think about our lives and think, how much would someone looking at us say, yes, I see that trait, I see that behaviour, I see that characteristic in those people? How much is our relationship with God flowing into and out of, into our lives and out of our lives to those we meet? And then Jesus finishes this passage by talking about salt and light. It's as though if this is how we are to be in relationship with God and with other people, then there are two important consequences. And as this particular block of teaching goes on through chapter 5, 6 and 7, we see many more consequences of living this way. But there are two that Jesus refers to here. He talks about being salt and light. And he says that you are the salt. He says you are the light. He doesn't say we should try to be. He doesn't say this should be the goal. He says that if you are living as one of my followers, you are salt and light. And it's a very positive statement. He doesn't actually say you are salt and you are light. He says you are the salt. You are the light. With the implication being that his followers are salt and light in the world, and no one else is. That's a thought. It's our job. And people like us who believe in and follow Jesus. The world needs it in a big way, and no one else can do it. That's the challenge of following Jesus. Salt and light, he talks about. In the time Jesus was living, there were two main uses of salt. It gave flavour to food and it preserved it. This is long before the time of fridges and deep freezes. What does this mean to us? We are to bring flavour into the world, probably with the idea of bringing God's wisdom to it. And we're to stand against the corruption that we see all around us. In other words, we are expected to make the world a better, a more godly place. And we're going to speak about the hope that is found in Jesus, the one who himself claimed to be the light of the world and who calls on his disciples to share that light with others. God's servant in the past, in Isaiah 42, was called to be a light to the nations. And this continues down to us today. Jesus shines his light into us. We allow that to shine through us. We reflect it into the world, into the situations we find ourselves in. But there is a warning about losing our saltiness, about losing our influence for good. about hiding the light we've been given and not sharing it with a needy world. And if we do that, there is no one else to bring God's wisdom, God's grace, God's good news to those who need it. In these study booklets we prepared for this series, and I'd encourage you to be thinking about them and reflecting on them. There's some questions that are raised this week about these particular things, about salt and light. Let me just share three of them with you to start your thinking. Jesus speaks about his followers being the light of the world. Does this excite you, challenge you, frighten you, or something else? How do you respond to that statement? Jesus says that people don't hide lights, they let them shine. The question we're asked to think about is, how do we hide our lights and not let them shine? And verse 16 tells us that we are to shine to bring glory to God. We're asked to think about what motivates what you do as a follower of Jesus. Some things to think about, to discuss, to reflect on this week. My question, as we've thought about Jesus talking about the blessedness that his followers can experience in ways that the people who are not following Jesus cannot begin to understand and comprehend. As Jesus calls us to recognize our position of being the salt and the light that this world so desperately needs, are we prepared to live as these people, as these disciples of Jesus? And to bring his salt and light to those who need it, so they can find and follow Jesus for themselves. We'll pray for a moment, and then Rachel's going to lead us in our last few moments together.